Welcome all. This is the fourth Sunday of March, and it's our Child Ed and UU Sunday. This is the Free Congregation of Sauk County. My name is Fritz Parks. I'm the administrator here.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Robin Proud. I'm one of the rotating speakers at the Free Congregation. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. That means that our invitation is to all, and all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. For our lighting of the candle, Fritz will light it, and I have a one sentence from our subject today, Elizabeth Blackwell. She said, if society will not admit a woman's free development, then society must be remodeled. So I'll give just a few sentences introduction before I start showing the slides here. So recently, in some of my presentations about women from history, I've gone a bit beyond the UUs, especially for your group. I've included some women who were free thinkers of various stripes. But today I'm squarely back in the UU world with a woman who specifically chose to be a Unitarian, just as she chose an unconventional career. Elizabeth Blackwell had been on my list for a while as someone who would be interesting to learn about. So when a new general interest book came out this year, I made sure to get that. It's called The Doctors Blackwell: How Two Pioneering Sisters Brought Medicine to Women and Women to Medicine by Janice Nimura, N-I-M-U-R-A. And it's about 300 pages, or maybe even less. Some of that is footnotes. And it's very readable, has pictures, which are some of the ones I'll be showing you today. So this is where I got a lot of my information. Nimura starts her book by talking about this plaque, which exists in Greenwich Village. And it says, this is the site of Elizabeth Blackwell's infirmary for women and children. In this building, the first female doctor in America, Elizabeth Blackwell, established the first hospital for, staffed, and run by women. The New York Infirmary for Women and Children opened on May 12, 1857, a date which was also the birthday of Blackwell's friend and collaborator, Florence Nightingale. Groundbreaking at the time, the hospital provided free medical care for indigent women and children and offered clinical experience and instruction for women determined to expand their skills as physicians. My brother lives in Greenwich Village, so next time I go there, I will be sure to stop by and see this plaque. It was not obvious that Elizabeth would end up here. Elizabeth Blackwell was born in 1821 in Bristol, England. This is a picture of her mother, Hannah Blackwell, and I think that always shows something about that this family was fairly well off if they could afford to have a portrait done. Elizabeth was the fourth child, but as was common at the time, the brothers on either side of her died in infancy. Eventually, there would be nine living children. This family, Hannah and her husband Samuel, were Protestant dissenters from the official Church of England. They valued education, hard work, the natural world, temperance, and abolition of slavery. But there was a little wrinkle to that, because Samuel made his living by running a sugar refinery, and everyone knew that sugar was produced by slaves in the Caribbean. Although Samuel and his wife Hannah seemed to have a good marriage, from what we can tell, none of the five Blackwell girls ever married. That's an extremely unusual statistic for the time. After a fire at his refinery, some business losses, and a series of violent riots in Bristol, Samuel and Hannah decided to leave for the promised land of America in 1832 when Elizabeth was 11. So Elizabeth would have had a British accent. But instead of changing careers, Samuel secured financial backing for another sugar refinery in the New York City area. Here's a young picture of Elizabeth. As a teenager, she enjoyed books more than socializing, and she was scornful of the fussy fashions she saw in the street in New York. She envied her brothers who could attend Columbia College, which is now Columbia University. And she wrote, "How I do long for some end to act for. To go on every day in just the same jog-trot manner is very wearisome." She wrote, "I wish I could devise some good way of maintaining myself, but the restrictions which confine my dear sex render all my aspirations useless." That is, she said, "I wish there was some way I could support myself, but there are restrictions." She complained about novels that seemed to be focused on marriage. "I wish some skillful pen would produce an interesting old maid's life." So she went on to have one. Unfortunately, her father Samuel's business once again suffered a fire and overall business downturn. Cheap land was available in the West, which at that time meant Ohio. Samuel hoped to grow his own sugar beets in order to produce sugar without slave labor. So in 1838, when Elizabeth was 17, the family moved to Cincinnati. And here's a picture that I found randomly from about that time. But the father, Samuel, became very ill and he died within 3 months of the move, leaving his wife and 9 children a total of $20. And even with inflation, that was not much. Brothers Sam and Henry, who were 15 and 13, went to work. The older sisters set up an academy in their home with themselves as teachers. It was around this time that Elizabeth met the ministers Lyman Beecher and William Henry Channing. And the author Janice Nomura writes about this. "Through Channing, the Blackwells encountered transcendentalism, which chimed with their own ideas regarding the natural goodness of humans." From this time on, Elizabeth considered herself a Unitarian and a transcendentalist. The academy the sisters started didn't pay enough, so Elizabeth took a riverboat to remote Henderson, Kentucky. She taught 21 girls in a dirt-floored schoolhouse. Her philosophical views found no companionship here. She wrote, "Emerson is a perfect stranger, and Channing, I presume, would produce a universal fainting fit." She only lasted 6 months in this uncongenial environment, but she enjoyed the feeling of earning money for the first time in her life. Then she was back in Cincinnati at the age of 23, hoping to make a living as a writer. It was at this time that a female friend of hers wished that someone like Elizabeth would become a doctor so that she could be treated by someone of her own sex when she had intimate problems. Elizabeth didn't immediately respond to this appeal. She had no special interest in medicine. If anything, she was repulsed by individual bodies and personalities. And here's what she herself wrote later in life. "I have no turn for benevolences. I feel neither love nor pity for men, for individuals. They may starve, cut each other's throats, or perform any other gentle diversion suitable to the age, without any attempt to stop them on my part for their own sakes. But I have boundless love and faith in man, with a capital M, and will work for the race day and night. In other words," you may have heard this before, "I love humanity. It's people I can't stand." Now, right at this time, Elizabeth may also have been influenced by the new book by Margaret Fuller, Woman in the 19th Century, with its call for women to take up every profession, even sea captain. American society, as you can imagine, was far from ready for this utopia. Elizabeth spoke with and wrote to multiple doctors. She constantly received the reply that her dream was impossible. The physical and mental rigors of the field were too much for women, not to mention the exposure to, gasp, bodies, and no medical school full of men would admit her. Medicine was following the same trajectory as many other sciences. The more it became codified, respected, and well paid, the more it was reserved for men. Women had been healers in traditional societies, and of course they did almost all the sick care at homes, but trained and paid medicine was the province of men. While teaching in Asheville, North Carolina, and Charleston, South Carolina, Elizabeth studied by dissecting insects and memorizing a skeleton. She continued to discuss her goal with doctors. One had an idea. She could go somewhere far away like Paris and dress as a man. And actually, at least one woman did that in history. She wasn't ready to do that. She was able to do some observation and study under a medical man in Philadelphia who supported her. He recommended her to Geneva Medical College in upstate New York. The faculty were taken aback by this odd request. They decided to defer the decision to the students. They felt confident the students would reject it. But the students almost unanimously voted yes, taking it mainly as a joke. But a few weeks later, a small, plainly dressed woman entered the classroom, making the whole class sit up and squelching the usual classroom chatter. Here's Geneva Medical College. There was much unwelcome publicity. Elizabeth was a scandalous figure in the town. Even across the ocean, the English satirical newspaper Punch wrote, "We admire Miss Blackwell, though we have never seen her. She is qualifying herself for that very important duty of a good wife, tending a husband in sickness." When the anatomy professor suggested she should stay home from his lecture on male reproductive organs, she calmly reminded him that she was there as a medical student and she would attend all the lectures. Medical school at this time was not yet standardized. Courses on anatomy, physiology, surgery, chemistry, and so on were crammed into 16 weeks. Students were required to attend the same lectures 2 years in a row, plus study with a, quote, respectable practitioner. The exams were given by the faculty. There was no system of boards or accreditation. And there was still a lot of emphasis on medicine, on expelling bad influences from the body by emetics, laxatives, and leeches. Elizabeth had little social life. But her anatomy professor teamed her with four other students to do dissections away from the larger crowd. She remembered fondly these fellows who, she said, treated me like an older sister. Between the 2 years of medical classes, the students were expected to work or observe in the field. A few doctors or institutions wanted a woman in that role. However, Elizabeth skillfully lobbied the various board members of Blockley Almshouse in Philadelphia. As the name suggests, this had been a hospital for the poor, and it still was, as well as a lunatic asylum. Here's what she wrote to her brother. Within 1 week, a lunatic scalded himself to death. One woman cut her throat. Another fell down a cellar opening and broke both legs and died the following day. Another jumped over the banisters, breaking both ankles. The doctors on site had no interest in helping Elizabeth. When I walked into the wards, they walked out. She found more welcome from the matron, who had long experience. Unfortunately, the experience Elizabeth had overall with women as patients and lowly employees of the hospital and in society did not engender respect. She wrote to her sister Emily, "Alas, poor woman, she seems to me inexpressibly mean in the sense of small-minded. It is not her intellectual inferiority I lament, but the petty, trifling, priest-ridden, gossiping, stupid, inane women of our day. What can we do with them? There are a few strong ones, a sort of exceptional eighth, perhaps. If they could be united, it would be a good beginning. You are one, and sometime or other we must work together, though the way does not seem clear yet." So Elizabeth always saw herself as an exception to what women were. While Elizabeth studied at Geneva that summer, 1848, in nearby Seneca Falls, the first formal meeting for women's rights adopted their declaration, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal." It called for greater opportunity in education and employment and for women's suffrage. At a second convention, also nearby in Rochester, New York, in August, Elizabeth Blackwell was praised for her perseverance as a harbinger of the day when women shall stand forth redeemed and disenthralled. Now, Elizabeth did not attend these, and she was not flattered to be mentioned. She wrote, "I don't sympathize with these reforming ladies. I'm very sorry my name was mixed up with the Rochester absurdity. They make themselves very foolish." When one of these foolish ladies sent her a praising letter, she wrote back that the problem lay not in the tyranny of men, but the weakness of women. She wrote, "Women are feeble, narrow, frivolous at present, ignorant of their own capacities and undeveloped in thought and feeling. So Elizabeth felt that women were not developed enough to be able to vote intelligently. This has echoes of our recent lean in idea. Women are supposed to change their behavior. And we have this modern issue of whether social problems lie in individual people or in systems. Elizabeth Blackwell saw the fault in individuals, not in the system that caused them to be that way. And she always seemed to see herself as something apart. Once she called herself a co-worker of God who was there to guide and help lesser mortals. Elizabeth finished at the top of her class, finding the exams, as she said, slight. She received her diploma in January 1849. She went to Philadelphia to attend additional lectures and practice dissection, and she polished her French because the place to really learn medicine at the time was Paris. Her reception in Paris was mixed and her degree unrecognized, but she was allowed to enter the maternity hospital as a student. So this was one good thing, that a woman was seen as okay to participate in women's medical issues. Standards of hygiene and what we today call PPE were low. Elizabeth was splashed in the eye with contaminated liquid and developed a serious eye infection. With no antibiotics in existence, doctors used such treatments as ammonia, sulfuric acid, and mercury. When her condition didn't improve, she traveled 800 miles to Berlin to take the water cure. This included bundling in wet sheets, bathing, drinking many glasses of water, and outside walks. As you might expect, this did nothing to help Elizabeth. She finally returned to Paris and had the eye removed and replaced with a glass prosthetic. Although she had good sight in the remaining eye, the loss meant she couldn't train as a surgeon, which was something she had hoped for. During this time, Elizabeth had been encouraging her younger sister, Emily, to follow her into a medical education. Emily was certainly ready for a change, writing in 1851, "I've been teaching for 5 years, and my disgust and hatred of this most detestable occupation has risen to a pitch that is almost unendurable. And life might be so glorious," she wrote. "Human nature so lofty, and yet people go on potter in their little contemptible lives and seem to have no more conception of the mysteries around them, of their marvelous existence, than beetles." Elizabeth returned to London, where she was beginning to be accepted while accompanying doctors on rounds. And this is a ticket for a lecture, and you can actually see her name, Miss Elizabeth Blackwell. In the evenings in London, she was disgusted by the appearance and behavior of women. Women so dressed out don't look like rational beings, and consequently, they cannot expect to be treated as such. And you'll see that Elizabeth and Emily never followed fashions of the day, dressed very soberly and conservatively. When the youngest Blackwell sister, Barbara, wrote enthusiastically of attending a National Women's Rights Convention in 1850, Elizabeth dismissed the group. And I think that's interesting that they almost represented two generations between the older and younger children of the family. And the youngest daughter was gung-ho for women's rights. But Elizabeth wrote, "These women show great energy, but not a great amount of strong, clear thought." She also assumed and disapproved that a call for women's rights was an anti-man movement. Of course, in her life, the only people who could have been her teachers or mentors were men. But she felt that other women should do as she had. Throughout her time in Europe, Elizabeth was never paid or subsidized for her study. She felt guilty that a cousin had helped support her. But now she had some influential friends, like the newspaper man Horace Greeley. She was able to raise funds, rent space in New York City, and advertise her services. Now, there was one obstacle. In the past, women who advertised medical services were often quacks, abortionists, or both. And here's a picture from the National Police Gazette showing the reputation of women in medicine. Madame Restel, the female abortionist, shown with some kind of evil-looking bat or something here, or devil figure. So this was the reputation she had to fight against. New Yorkers were rightly skeptical. However, in the years that Elizabeth had been in Europe, medical schools for women had actually been established in Boston and Philadelphia. This was remarkable progress. perhaps inevitably, a backlash followed. Now that women had their own colleges, men thought, there was no reason to admit them to the established male ones. Still, a small group of women who had acquired medical knowledge formed around Elizabeth, including her sister, Emily. Emily had gained experience observing at Bellevue Hospital in New York and then attended Rush Medical School in Chicago. They seemed to welcome her, but after the first year, the trustees held an emergency meeting and voted that she could not continue. And here's a picture of Emily around that time. So the trustees basically kicked her out. That decision was denounced in the press by the Chicago Tribune and by the male medical students. But Emily didn't wait for a legal challenge. She moved on to Cleveland Medical College, where she finished with high marks. When Elizabeth opened her dispensary for poor women and children in New York, Emily traveled to Scotland. Here's a ticket for her observation at Edinburgh Maternity Hospital. She was mentored by Dr. James Simpson, an expert in midwifery and women's diseases, at the prestigious University of Edinburgh. Elizabeth longed for a colleague in New York. She wrote to Emily in the spring of 1854, "This medical solitude is really awful at times. I should thankfully turn to any decent woman to relieve it if I could find one." Well, 3 days later, Elizabeth received a visit from Marie. Oh, just a second here. All right, before we get to that, this was a character in Punch about Emily. So Emily apparently is supposed to be this lady on the right who, with the glasses and looking very unpleasant. And here's Marie Zakshevska, is how it's pronounced, who turned up on Elizabeth's doorstep. She was a Polish woman who had studied medicine in Berlin, and she seemed to be a sort of kindred spirit. She wrote in her own autobiography, "I have accomplished more than many women of genius and education would have done in my place, for the reason that confidence and faith in their own powers were wanting." So this was a woman who had much confidence. Elizabeth helped Marie get into Cleveland Medical College. So, but at that point, Elizabeth was left on her own. She closed the dispensary, which had been wearing her down. She bought a house and took in a 6-year-old Irish girl from an orphanage. She said, "I mean to train her up into a valuable domestic if she prove on sufficient trial to have the qualities I give her credit for." The child Catherine Parry, called Kitty, though labeled stupid by the orphanage, turned out to be bright, hardworking, and of a sunny disposition. She was told to call her mentor, Dr. Elizabeth. And the first time she was introduced to a male physician, she exclaimed, "How very odd it is to hear a man called doctor." Throughout her life, Kitty retained this odd position of not quite daughter and not quite servant. While Elizabeth and Emily had been traveling and studying, their younger brothers, Henry and Sam, were still in Cincinnati. They were now running a hardware business. It was there that Henry Blackwell met Lucy Stone. She was already famous as an early female graduate of Oberlin College and a regular lecturer on abolition and women's rights. Henry wrote, "I decidedly prefer her to any lady I ever met." Maybe having such iconoclastic sisters inclined him toward this strong-minded woman. There was one small problem. She didn't believe in marriage, seeing it, rightly at the time, as a form of bondage. Henry sent Lucy books, helped her arrange speaking tours, and even made a feminist speech himself at the 4th National Women's Rights Convention. But here's how he really won her heart. In 1854, Henry was alerted to a Southern family passing through Cincinnati by train. He approached the family's young enslaved girl, asked her if she wanted to be free, and when she said yes, forcibly removed her from the train. This endeared him to Lucy Stone, and they arranged to be married, with Henry reading at the ceremony a public protest against the existing laws denying married women their rights. Sister Elizabeth objected to this public airing of private views as vulgar vanity, but Henry went ahead with his statement, as well as omitting the word obey from the ceremony. Lucy Stone introduced into her new family her friend from Oberlin, Antoinette Brown. She was the first woman to preach in a congregational church. And within the year, Elizabeth's brother Sam married Antoinette, also called Nettie. So this was a very high-powered family. And the next year, Henry, Sam, their wives, and their mother all moved into the big house Elizabeth owned in New York City. Marie Zakshefska, known to all as Dr. Zach, was there, along with Elizabeth's companion, Kitty. And in 1856, Nettie gave birth in the house to Florence, named for, of course, another famous medical woman, Florence Nightingale. And the same month, Emily returned from Europe. At this time, the New York Infirmary for Indigent Women and Children opened in a brick building which had once been the home of the Roosevelt family. Henry Ward Beecher was the keynote speaker. 2 months later, the New York Times ran a laudatory article called "What the Lady Doctors Are Doing." They noted the home-like atmosphere, as fresh and clean as if just swept by the proverbial new broom. The nursing care was assumed to be good, they wrote, if one may judge from the physiognomy of the motherly-looking dames who have charge. Not everyone was so sure. The women had newfangled ideas about hygiene, which was still a new idea in medicine. When one woman died in the maternity ward, nefarious rumors spread. More than once, mobs gathered outside the hospital. So even without Facebook and Twitter, all kinds of rumors could spread and cause people to assemble. There were still many who refused to accept female doctors, or if they allowed that such a thing could be helpful to the poor, they declined to accept those doctors into their own drawing rooms. Elizabeth wrote, "When a woman has won herself an honorable position in any unusual line of life, she is still excluded from the companionship and privileges of the class to which she should belong, because her course is unusual. Let us learn to regard women as human beings, as well as women." Elizabeth did have a few backers. For example, Lady Byron, widow of the infamous poet who she had met in England. Elizabeth wrote to her in 1857, "Very few understand the soul of this work or the absolute necessity which lies upon me to live out the ideal life to the utmost extent of my power. My work is undoubtedly for the few and is necessarily difficult of appreciation to the mass, very slowly gaining their esteem." At least she had a few allies. She wrote, "My sister is a noble helper, and we shall stand, I trust, shoulder to shoulder through many years of active service." With Emily and Marie in place, Elizabeth decided to make one more voyage to England. Let's see what we have here. Oh, here's a picture of the annual report from the infirmary. So Elizabeth went to England with 10-year-old Kitty as her companion. But she seemed to have some strange ideas of what to do with the child. Once she got to England, she dispatched Kitty to her brother's home and thence to a boarding school. Kitty was miserable. She was alone in a new culture, suffering the common English school fates of bullying and chilblains. She wrote letters begging Elizabeth to rescue her, but the school never mailed them. Finally, the resourceful Kitty mailed one in town during a school outing, and Elizabeth finally responded. However, Elizabeth had moved on to Paris. Kitty was sent alone by train, ferry, and another train with just an address in her pocket. At the Paris train station, no one was there to meet her. It turned out Elizabeth had gone to the wrong station, which can happen in Paris, where there are multiple stations. The officials put Kitty into a carriage. She didn't know what was happening. She later recalled, "Having read, small as I was, too much about the revolution, I expected to be carted off to prison or the guillotine." Luckily, Elizabeth, arriving at the correct station, recognized Kitty's trunk on the back of the cab. So that story isn't necessarily relevant, but I just thought it was kind of charming as a recollection of the time and something about Kitty, who does seem an interesting figure. Elizabeth's main occupation in Paris was giving a series of lectures on women's health for Parisian ladies. She gave a remarkably frank talk on women's reproductive organs. On her return to New York, plans for a larger hospital, clinic, / living space were interrupted by the outbreak of the Civil War. The Blackwell sisters were, of course, enthusiastic Union supporters. They advertised a meeting at the Cooper Institute's Great Hall. Women were to come to organize themselves as volunteers and for donations. Between 2,000 and 3,000 women attended, and here's a drawing of what it looked like. Many of the women would work collecting supplies, rolling bandages, and knitting socks, but Elizabeth was named chair of the registration committee tasked with recruiting women for direct medical work. From this meeting was born the most important civilian organization of the Civil War, the Sanitary Commission. However, the leaders excluded from any war work the Blackwell's Infirmary, and they excluded any public leadership by the Blackwell's. The fear was that their reputation would sully the good name of the new organization. They were too controversial. Elizabeth wrote, "Of course, as it is essential to open the hospitals to nurses, we kept in the background. Had there been any power to support us, we would have fought for our true place, but there was none." The Sanitary Commission moved on to Washington, D.C., and the sisters in New York, without recognition, trained at least 100 nurses for war work. Though the Blackwell sisters had looked askance at the new women's medical colleges because their goal was to have women admitted to the existing men's colleges, the quality of learning in the female graduates they took on at the clinic didn't impress them. But when the third U.S. medical school for women opened right in New York City, the sisters decided they needed to join the movement to assure education at the level they expected. In 1863, Elizabeth had announced her interest in opening a really good school of medicine, but the war subsumed all other interests. The Women's Medical College of the New York Infirmary opened in 1868. Theirs was the first of the women's institutions and maybe of all such colleges to offer a three-year curriculum that built from year to year without repetition. So yeah, let's go here. We can see Elizabeth and Emily a bit later in life. They were the first school to offer a course on hygiene taught by Emily. Now, much of Elizabeth's time was devoted to administration and fundraising, which were not her favorite endeavors. Also, as Emily became more confident and experienced, Elizabeth was no longer the undisputed leader, which led to some conflicts. Elizabeth decided to travel back to England. She rejoiced in her freedom from the everyday concerns of the hospital, writing, "I would sink the whole thing in the bottom of the Sound rather than come back to it." In England, Elizabeth was the first woman to be placed on the British Medical Register. In her last 20 years, Elizabeth remained in England, where she expanded her interest in hygiene to campaigns against prostitution and in favor of chastity. This was partly in response to the scourge of syphilis. She also had some opinions we might not agree with today. She campaigned against vaccination based on one experience where an infant had died. She was also against vivisection, that is, experimentation on animals. Like many other prominent thinkers of the time, she was interested in the developing science of eugenics and breeding, which we have some concerns about today. And like many in the second half of the 19th century, she developed an active interest in spiritualism. So the lines around the interests of science were still rather fluid. Emily continued to run the Women's Medical College until 1899, at which time women were taking their place as students in institutions like Johns Hopkins and Cornell. And that's what Eleanor mentioned, having a relative that may have been one of the first at Johns Hopkins. Elizabeth and Emily died within months of each other in 1910. And here's a picture, 1905, Elizabeth and Kitty, both up there in years. Elizabeth is buried in Scotland, a place she had loved in her travels. And I'll go off of the screen sharing here. Janice Nimura ends her biography this way. In 1910, when the Blackwell sisters died, there were more than 9,000 women doctors in the United States, about 6% of all physicians. Today, 35% of physicians and slightly more than half of all medical students are female. But as we know, there are still many obstacles to women in the sciences and in other fields. And it brings up a question as to how many intelligent lives were wasted. If Elizabeth and Emily had stayed at home keeping house all that time, what a waste that would have been. And this is true of other marginalized groups as well. If we think of how many people have not had the opportunity to develop the talents that they naturally would have. And the closing from Elizabeth Blackwell. "None of us can know what we are capable of until we are tested."
Thank you, Robin.